I'm very pleased to welcome.
I'll turn my phone off.
What are you doing? You turn your phone off. That's a good start for a podcast interview. We're live, listeners, and I'm very pleased to tell you I've got with me here in the west end of Fremantle, Ed Feathers, who is known to most people as Dr. Ed Feathers, and in one capacity, but he has a number of capacities. Welcome, Ed.
Well, thanks very much, Mike. It's great to be here. Yeah.
When did you first come to discover, however you want to put it, Fremantle?
Well, look, there's been a couple of discoveries. The early informative discoveries occurred because of our parents' association with Fremantle. Our next door neighbour, who made models of ships that came into the Fremantle harbour, my mother worked at the Bank of New South Wales down here in Fremantle. And I sailed with Bill Sampson, a Fremantle name that many people might know, and I also sailed with Eric Salomons, who lived in Fremantle. So many aspects drew me to Fremantle.
It's a place, isn't it? Bill Sampson, whose name you've just mentioned, was one of the first podcast interviews done on Fremantle Shipping News. A great story, the Sampson story. But what's this little fella here, Ed? This little sailor chap.
Look, I've brought this little sailor chap in today, Michael, to show you and to talk about. This little sailor chap lived in Captain Trevett and Mrs. Trevett's house on Arthur Head. There's three houses up there, and he was the pilot first and then became the harbour master, and he lived there. And they were friends of my grandfather, Eric Francis Feathers and Linda. And so they gave that little man to my grandmother, and my grandmother had it on her kitchen sink, and I can recall seeing it in her house when I was about 3 or 4 years of age. So it goes back a long way, and it's now in my possession. He's got a really smiley little face and got that bell-bottom blues on, and he looks happy.
We'll take a photograph, put him up with a story, if they can have a good look, but tell them as well who Captain Trevett was and what years you're talking about.
Well, Captain Trevett was in Fremantle, Michael, as I said, in the house there, firstly as the pilot between 1920 and 1943. He was then the harbour master between 1926 to 85, and he lived at 12 Captain's Lane, one of those three houses up on Arthur Head, particularly ideally located in those days to the Corker Landing, so that they could just jog down there, get on the boat, and go out and welcome the ships. So that was his role, quite a long, nearly 60 years of living in one of those houses up there.
Amazing place to live. I mean, you can actually see across the water to Madagascar, you can look down into the inner harbour, you can go down, probably not so easy at different times, onto Bathers Beach to have a swim. You can do it more easily now. But what an amazing part of Fremantle. So did you come down to Fremantle and visit him in the house there?
I don't recall visiting him in the house at all, no. My grandfather was the superintendent of the wheat board here in Western Australia, so his work, the colony had gone beyond having enough wheat for the colony, essentially. And so in about 1937, he travelled to Europe and helped to introduce the exporting of wheat and getting some markets going and exploring all those avenues. So he had a bit to do with, naturally, the export of wheat out of the Fremantle Harbour.
And you think that was the connection at a personal level with the harbour?
Yes,
master?
I believe it was a personal level, and they often spoke about them very fondly.
Yeah. But what a funny and interesting and wonderful little thing to have, this little chap.
Well, it's funny how these things get into the back of your brain, don't they? And and some people say to me, after many years of being in Fremantle and working in Fremantle, hey, Ed, you've got to be born here to be Fremantle. And I sometimes think, well, from the outside, sometimes you have Fremantle associations without actually being born here.
Yes, yes. You don't have to be born here, but it helps.
Yes, indeed.
Or got a connection that was born here, or a possible connection that was born here. Well, you've been here a long time now. How long do you say you've been associated with the greater Fremantle area?
So I suppose my real association with Fremantle was when I was about 15 or 16, when I used to come to the Sampsons' home in Preston Point Road, and get up to some mischief, as you do at that time of your life, with my friend Bill Sampson and some of our other mates. So that was my first real time. Then shortly after that, when I was about 19, I was introduced by Bill Sampson's father, Derek, who was an ocean racer himself, to Eric Salomons, who was a Fremantle man, lived down here, and operated a floor at the markets when they were up in West Perth. And Eric had an ocean-going yacht called Josephine. It was a Sunset-class yacht. There was a few of them around at that time. And I got into the crew and had 3 or 4 years, maybe a little longer, with Eric on Josephine and a few of his other boats. And then, of course, knowing him, I was in his house and down here and meeting people of his connection from here in Fremantle. So that was sort of about 1920.
So you were just starting to sort of A, grow into Fremantle and B, grow into sailing. Where did your sailing take you after that? Some sort of apprenticeship with him, by the sound.
Well, it's been a journey, Michael.
Yes.
It's been a great journey. It's been a wonderful journey for me. It started as a sailor myself, and particularly loving the ocean and the isolation of that, and the competitive racing that you get in the ocean, and the reliance on the team and that sort of thing. And then it grew from that into some river racing, with a equally designed competitive yachts. And then after that, I moved into the media. I'm not sure that that's the right side. It's sometimes called the dark side, but I moved into the media because as you advance in years, you become a little less fit, you become a little less relevant. But by being in the media and talking about sailing, commentating on sailing, you still stay in touch with the young competitive sailors. And it's been a great joy and I've loved it.
Yeah. Well, you have a fairly regular radio program, don't you?
I have a regular radio program. You know. Yeah.
I do know.
You do.
But tell our listeners about it.
91.3 Sport FM. It's been going for about 10 years. We broadcast half an hour on sailing each week on Thursdays. And it's a great sport radio station. And it's really nice to get sailing involved with other competitive sports. Jacob Landsmere and Jack Crawshaw are now running that radio station and doing a mighty job in bringing all the sport to the listeners. It's based up in Hamilton Hill, and it's a great privilege to be able to spend half an hour up there with the young people once again, talking about the sport that I love, sailing, and all the people in it.
And you have a bit to do with Fremantle Sailing Club?
Yeah, I have a bit to do with Fremantle Sailing Club because many of the events are out of Fremantle Sailing Club. Even this week, out of there is the World Flying 15 Championships, and there's some 79 boats down here with people from four continents from all over the world. So there's an event down there, and there are often events out of Fremantle Sailing Club. But I'm a member of Royal Perth Yacht Club and Royal Freshwater Bay Yacht Club, and Royal Perth Yacht Club has very fortunately the annex in the harbour there, and that's a terrific spot to hang out, and if there's regattas on, that's a great place to go.
Speaking of the Flying 15s, the F-15s, which have been on, they're quite small little craft, take 2 sailors, as I understand it.
Yeah, that's right, Michael. They were designed by a chap called Ufa Fox, or Ufa Fox, double F, so Flying 15, double F, and many of them have got the double Fs in their name. They're raced in mostly the British nation and the British colonies, Michael. So you get them in New Zealand and South Africa and Hong Kong here, and there's a strong fleet in Western Australia. Two sailors, it's a bit of hiking involved, very competitive. And it's a good competition. I'm really enjoying watching it here in Fremantle.
Now, over the years, and it might have been in any order, you don't have to graduate from small to big, do you? You may have gone the other way. What was the smallest craft that you sailed? Comparatively,
it was a Gwen 12. It was a yacht called a Gwen 12.
Never heard of it.
But they were all the rage in those days. They had one skipper who hung on to the tiller, and the trapeze person, which was me, with your feet on the side and hanging out with the wire that you hooked onto it. So it was athletic and fun. Mm.
Yeah. And what was your favourite vessel that you ever sailed, favourite yacht, big or small? over the years.
Whoa, jeepers, that's really
hard. You have to be careful when you
answer
this.
Hard to make a favourite because they all have different aspects. In the sport of sailing, there are so many genres of sailing, and I think this is sometimes difficult for people to understand because we talk about round-the-world yachts, we talk about match racing yachts, we talk about world championships, we talk about fleets of Olympic classes, we talk about catamarans and monohulls. So sometimes it's really difficult to pick. So I don't know that I have a real favourite, except to say that the family favourite and the one that kept us together was the Endeavour 24.
Tell us a bit more about that.
Well, it's a little boat. It's about a 24-foot yacht. It was a family yacht, sailed with the family, sailed against some mates. Some of them, their children have gone on to big sailing events. So it was a bit of a grounding where people came through and they've gone on to amazing things, like America's Cup. You take Ben Durham, he sailed in the fleet. He's now the coach of the Australian Sail GP team, but his dad sailed. Our own son, Andy Feathers, he sailed in 4 America's Cup campaigns.
Amazing.
You go through the fleet, and there was many people that have ended up in different sailing careers and at a very high level. So it wasn't so much the mums and dads racing the boat. Matt Wern, who won the Olympic gold medal in Tokyo in the men's laser class, his parents, Karen and Brad, had an Endeavour 24. So the little tacker came through there, and he's gone on to that level. So it was a fleet where the outcome was greater than the people who were actually racing it at the time, if that makes some sense.
It does. A race that everybody knows about, a bit like the Melbourne Cup, but in yachting is the Sydney Hobart. And I've got here, it looks like a media pass for one Edward Feathers from 2017.
Yeah, Michael, if you want to get to watch the sport of yachting, it's often way, way out on the horizon.
Isn't it? You need good binoculars, or you need to be on someone else's boat out there.
Or someone else's boat.
Yeah.
So being an accredited media, thanks to my work with 91.3 Sport FM, I was able to get out on a boat right in amongst the start of the Sydney Hobart, and then carried out to the first couple of marks out at the heads. So you're in amongst the fleet in a privileged area, you get some great action, you can see what the sailors are doing. And we had in 2017, I think, something like 3 West Australian boats in the race. So it was great to see them on the water, even for that short period of time. And the best part of it at all is you got the great Sydney Hobart start in Sydney, and you didn't have to bash your way down the coast and get wet and miserable straight back to the CYC for a nice cleansing beer and home to your own bed.
Although I'm sure they all love it, unless their mast breaks and they have to go into Eden or somewhere on the way down. But what about these big round-the-world races? We get the Clipper race coming through Fremantle every now and then. They'll probably be here before too long once again. But they're interesting. They put sailing and yachting on some other sort of pedestal again, do they? Or they raise its visibility?
Well, yes, that's right. The Clipper race is designed for amateurs, paying amateurs, to actually have the experience of sailing in legs around the world. They do a leg from, say, Cape Town to Fremantle, or a leg from, say, Fremantle to somewhere in South America. And they do different legs, or they can do the whole journey, but it's a paying, and you go to training and you learn how to do it. And yes, it's one of the many round the world races, but we're very fortunate that we have some great round the world races. And probably when you're looking for a favourite, it's the Vendée Globe. It's the single-handed, unassisted, leaves Le Sable d'Olonne. It's once every 4 years, and it goes around the world without stopping, and it returns to Le Sable d'Olonne. And this is a great race. Sebastian Destremo, who lived here for a while in Perth and was instrumental in bringing on some of our young match races, he sailed in the event last time round, and it was good to see him. but they sometimes get into trouble in the Vendée Globe and in any round the world race once they get into the Indian Ocean. So once they're between South Africa, Cape Town and Fremantle, things happen. So when the round the world races are on and it's that time of the year, if you keep your eyes or listen to us on 91.3 Sport FM, if I can put in a plug, we will advise you if any of the damaged boats are coming up to Fremantle where they come for refuge, and then you can go down and meet them, talk with the crews, have a look on the boats. They're all very welcoming. So it's an opportunity that comes here occasionally when there's a round the world race on.
Well, the Dutch and the Portuguese and probably the Brits to a lesser extent perfected the crashing the boats into our coast all those years ago, I suppose, when you think about it.
Well, indeed they did. And not only did they crash them into the coast, but they had pirates like Dampier, you know.
Yes, the brigand.
He was a brigand, but he preyed on them as they came up the coast here too. And I think that must have been great fun, you know, like hanging out in the sand up there and then heading out to attack whatever he could find. I think that must have been good fun.
Now, as a young man, you found your way down here professionally, did you not? To a Stalinist, brutalist-looking hospital over there in Fremantle.
Michael, I came to Fremantle Hospital as a young resident in 1973. Having struggled through the course of medicine, I came to Fremantle Hospital, and it was an absolute... the best thing that ever happened to me. We had a small number of residents in the hospital at that time, maybe six or seven, very few residents. And the next level up in your medical training is a registrar level before you get to being a consultant. And often there were not enough registrars, so we would like straight to the consultants. So we had some terrific consultants down at Fremantle Hospital and plenty of action in Fremantle to work on. Some of the nightclubs and the incidents in the nightclubs.
The war zone.
Some of the terrorists down in White Gum Valley and the racing of cars and the accidents.
Much more demure, even gentrified these days.
Oh, it is these days. It's totally changed, but it wasn't like that in those days. And so we dealt with pretty much everything. And we also, very fortunately, Fremantle Hospital had an association with the Kimberley. So the children that were ill in the Kimberley were brought down to Fremantle Hospital. Obviously very, very confronting for some of them, and they came to the children's ward at Fremantle Hospital. So that was a great place to go to, particularly on a Saturday when South Fremantle were playing, because you could look from the two wards there right over the football ground while you were doing your rounds with the kids. And when they got better, because children did, once they had some fluids and recovered a bit, and it was good fun to muck about with those people down from the Kimberley.
Yeah. Well, we could talk long and hard about South Fremantle and East Fremantle and football matches, I suppose, but one of the interesting things I always find as I walk through what is now called Wallula Court, used to be called King Square, is this amazing, I imagine it's in bronze, statue of John Curtin, who was once the member from Fremantle. Did you ever have any connection with John Curtin?
Michael, John Curtin became the member in Fremantle, or faced an election here in 1937. And my mother's father, Eric Isaacson, was his competitor, and he stood against John Curtin in that election for the United Australia Party. John Curtin won the election and from there carried on, and we all know the future of what happened to John Curtin. But when I was looking at some of this for some family history work that I'm doing, I was surprised to see that the electorate of Fremantle and the Fremantle Ballywick goes much, in those days, went a lot larger than what people now understand Fremantle to be, because the federal seat of Fremantle extended as far as Wembley and almost up to Victoria Park, it seems, with my research on these figures.
It's astonishing. This document I'm looking at here, it has Claremont, East Fremantle, Fremantle, Leederville, North Fremantle, South Fremantle, South Perth, Victoria Park, Wembley Park.
Yeah.
And That's the seat of Fremantle.
Well, does this actually mean, if this is in fact the accuracy of this, is, it seems to be correct, does this actually mean that people that live in Cottesloe and in Wembley are now could be called Fremantle residents or people from Fremantle? I'm not sure.
Fremantle people.
Fremantle people.
Yes.
I don't know.
Well, like people at election time, it might cause some gnashing of teeth, Ed. But Eric Isaacson, your grandfather, he did quite well. He got 40.86% of the vote. Mind you, Curtin got 55.24%.
And then went on to... Yeah, I think the figures would be pretty much the same now, Michael, for the seat of Fremantle,
yes.
Pretty much. It's a pretty safe Labor seat, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes. Mm. Yeah. Well, how interesting. But life goes on. You progress in your career as a medico. You're here and there, and you become very much tied to the greater Fremantle area. You continue on in sailing. You eventually get into the media, but you must have been around the edges, if not right at the centre of the America's Cup. Did you ever get into the America's Cup in any practical way before it was won in Newport and defended in Fremantle?
Alan Bond was keen to win the America's Cup. He had an ocean racing yacht. And Yanchep Sun City was a place that people may know. So we had an ocean race up to Yanchep Sun City, and Alan Bond got up in the hall there at the time and said to the gathered folk, sailors at large, after everyone had had a few beers to keep their fluids up after a fairly stressful race, that he was going to win the cup and he was looking for sailors. So he bought one of the Gretels, and he brought the Gretel over here. The Gretel had been in a previous cup and had brought it over to here. It was in North Fremantle. And some of us went down and started rubbing it down and started to get a bit involved in all of that. But it was at a formative time in my life, and I just started my general practice in East Fremantle in 1980, and I think I had two children by then, and maybe a third on the way. So it didn't seem like this was going to actually allow me to progress for all of that. So the Longleys and the Lissamans and the others went on that path and won the cup, as we know, in 1983. And then it came back in 1987 to Fremantle for its defence. Well, what a story that was. Of course, everybody knows how much Fremantle changed. It changed dramatically. Stan Reed was the medical director at King Edward Hospital, and he knew me because we'd been racing against each other in the ocean. He said, Ed, these 12 metres that are here in the America's Cup and are coming off Fremantle, it's going to be pretty rough out there, it's going to be pretty strong winds and the booms are really low and we're worried about an incident. So I want you to put together a medical team and get them out on the water. So we had our own chase boat and we had some young guys that could pull marks when the older mark lads had trouble because it was deep and needed to get them up. So we had three young guys and myself, and every day we had a doctor out there for the Challenger series, not for the Defender series. For those for the Challenger series were doing their own thing, but we were there with the Australia 2 and the Kookaburra and all of that. So we had a medical place on the water every day. We went out there about 11 o'clock. I'd go to the surgery, see some patients, go out on the water, do the job, come back, see some patients and try and run both shows all at the same time. And how good was it? We were right in the action. We couldn't get any closer. And then when the cup eventually was on, those races in the end, when it was so easily won by Connor, you couldn't get any closer than our chase boat to watch the America's Cup here in Fremantle. And
what's
I've
this?
Still got the badge. I've
what's
still got
this?
Your badge, the
what
official
is that?
Badge. That's the course doctor, official, 1987 Royal Perth Yacht Club, Ed Feathers. You have to have one of these. It's on a piece of string. No fancy lanyards, just a piece of string.
Well, I'll slip that in my pocket, and next time there's a quiz night, I'll try and raffle it off. It'll do well, I should think. But he can sit over there with a little sail, and we'll take a picture of him. Well, the America's Cup wasn't successfully defended here, much to the pity. As you say, Connor seemed to take it away with relative ease. But the sort of craft that thereafter started to race for the America's Cup became quite different. They hardly needed a winged keel. They seemed to start flying above the ocean. What happened?
They went from the 12 metre into a larger monohull, the AC5, I think it was called. It was a much bigger boat. The America's Cup in San Diego was the next one after the Fremantle 87 unsuccessful defence here. Stan Reed, who we were talking about earlier, went over there to do the race course management and invited me to come over there and work with him on that regatta. And once again, I chose the career path rather than going over there to that, and that was a good choice. So they raced those for a while until 2003. They raced those AC5s until 2003. Then it went to Valencia, 2007. Still the same boats. Then after that, there was a deed of gift challenge where there was the big boats, and it's very crazy, the America's Cup. And then they went to the catamarans, and then they were the ones that fly on the top of the water. So they were really wild boats. They were crazy boats. And of course, sadly, took a life of one of the sailors, Bart Simpson. Andy, our son, was on board the boat that day. Very sad. He was a mate of his, but the boys have moved on, I think, as if you can, from those events. It was in San Francisco, it was dangerous. And even now, the boats they're racing now are pretty dangerous, Michael. They go really fast, and they're on these foils that lift them out of the water. So they have now, instead of like a main sheet hand and a skipper and a sail trimmer, they have a flight controller that uses like a joystick, like a gamer, that lifts it out of the water. They have a wing trimmer. They have a driver. And those roles are now totally different, but they're still working together. A lot of instrumentation on board, and all of that development that goes on does eventually flow down from a development class like an America's Cup boats into sailing at large. So eventually, stuff comes out of that, which is then used by the sailing community at large for different things.
Well, people ask, when we were younger, Edmund Hillary, why bother to climb to the top of Mount Everest? You sort of got it. It was there. It could be conquered. People wonder about extreme sports, and America's Cup racing in particular could almost be put in that category. What is it? People just want to go faster? Do they want to greater challenge in sailing? What made the young Andy become so involved?
The Olympic thing is higher, faster and stronger. So there's all of that involved in the sport of sailing, and sailing is in the Olympic Games, so it's part of all that. But it's also part of the bimbling that goes on with boats. It's the part of developing a boat. You get a boat, you want to change the rudder style, or you want to change the way the ropes are feeding through blocks. You want to change how things are happening. So it's how you develop all of that. So it gets down to not only racing the boat on the race course, but it gets down to the engineering that's involved in making a boat change or go faster or do different things. And so there's all of that involved in it. Of course, in a class like Flying 15, which we've got the Worlds in Fremantle here at the moment, it's all measured, it's all equal, and it's that's how it is. So it's down to the athletes. In an Olympic class like the Laser, the Matt Wern one, it's all equal, it's down to the people that sail, it's the athletes. But in a development class like the Moths or like the America's Cup boats, it's all down to the development of those boats and what you can get it to do with the design people behind. So the sailors themselves are really delivering on the technology. That's a different aspect to it. Yeah.
What, say, whatever is the relevant period, I'm guessing it might have been the last 20 years, have been the significant technological developments in sailing, particularly the ones that might have found their way down into the more ordinary classes?
I think the carbon is the thing. I mean, the carbon, it's lighter and it's stronger, and making that in an oven is probably the big thing that's made it different, I reckon.
I noticed that the professional golf associations are thinking once again, if they can't keep making the holes longer for the professional golfers, taking the long sticks off them, which they've done for putting, and I think changing the technology on drivers and golf clubs so they just can't hit the ball as far. Is that likely to be an issue in sailing, to pull them back from the brink?
In those development classes, there's no stopping them. They'll keep going as far and as fast as they can to make them do what they're designed to do. And even the Vendée boats now, with their foils on the side and lifting out of the water in the ocean, are spectacular. But when you're talking about the technology of sailing, not only has it been the technology of the sailing and the fibres that they're using and the designs of the boats and the engineering, Michael, the way that the sport is covered has changed so much too. It's gone from the binoculars and somebody just talking about it on the radio to the drones, to the video footage. Even in the, we were talking earlier about the around the world races, they take their own drones on the boats, they fly them up, take the pictures, beam them ashore so that the public can look at them. So there's a lot of looking at yachting on the screens at home.
And it's a spectacular thing to watch, isn't it? And come to the Fremantle Sailing Club. It seems to me, from someone who lives reasonably close by and watches what goes on and around Fremantle, that it's been a great success, having come here, having been created. How do you see it?
Are you referring to having sailing clubs in the mixed into the community?
Yes.
Yes, I think that's been a great thing. In the past, in the early days of Fremantle, the yachting was done out of the hotels. So the hotels were the basis for where they gathered after the racing, down here in Fremantle in particular. Attilo Valmadre, or the Valmadre Cup is a Fremantle event. He had a hotel in Fremantle and was the donator of the original Valmadre Cup, which has quite a story for it. We don't have time for that. But in any event, then you get your clubs. But the good thing about a yachting club is that the resources are there to pool everything to allow the training for the up-and-coming new young people into the sport. So your dinghy club becomes a real centre where people come to the sport of sailing, they learn the sport of sailing, they learn the aspects of it, they learn all the side things that come out of sailing, and then they find sponsors through the yachting clubs which will help them advance their career and perhaps springboard them onto the world stage in sailing events, which you need if you're going to become at the top of the game, like Matt Werner or other people that have done well here in America's Cups and things like that. You need that springboard out of here. So the club can add to that. And also the club can be an interface between the community, a very strong community like Fremantle, with the yacht club, because there's a nice interface which worked well together. There's benefits for each, I think, synergies that can work, where they can work together in a way that is advantage. Ideal recreational facilities for the people of Fremantle, and also an ideal meeting place and a club where sometimes the facilities, the food and that side of thing is a great place to go.
Yeah, it is. It's a very good place, and people listening to this, if they don't know, can become social members and enjoy it. It's a great ambience, isn't it? And then you've got the three other harbours of Fremantle with Challenge, Fishing Boat and Success. I mean, there are parts of the world you go where you think of them as sailing and yachting places, but we've got this amazing setup with all sorts of craft in it.
I commentate a bit as well as have a radio show. So I commentate on sailing. I commentate for the Harbour Race here in Fremantle. I commentate for the Rumble in the Reach, an event at East Fremantle Yacht Club. Have been doing that for a number of years. And I commentate for an event called the Warren Jones International Youth Match Racing Regatta, where young people come and race against each other in one-on-one racing. Some people, I've heard a whisper, are talking about an event for that match racing in the Fishing Boat Harbour. Now, it's only talk, I hear, but I'm fairly close to these things. And I'd like to tell you, Michael, and Fremantle Shipping News, that if there's any way that can happen, Wouldn't that be great to see that event down in Fremantle with those youth racing inside the fishing boat harbour? Now, there's a lot of future in this, and I think there's a lot of talking yet to be done. But I did see your mare, Hannah Fitzharding, at the lunch for the Warren Jones Regatta this year. So I like to spread a bit of rumour, Michael.
Well, when the blessing of the fleet's on, of course, they put all of, just about anyone who can cram onto one or two or three boats and push them around. But I can imagine some smaller craft in there zigzagging this way and that.
And the backdrop for photographs.
Backdrop magnificent.
Magnificent.
Different positions, a couple of media boats for you and me.
We'd need a media boat.
We'd need a media boat.
We would need a good media boat.
Very good media boat.
Yeah.
Well, I think there's a future in this. Ed, you've been to a few America's Cups?
Yes, after the 1987 one here in Fremantle, I went to Auckland where Young Australia was competing, and then I'd been to San Diego. New Zealand won it the first time, they were defending it. I was only there for a short period of time, but I had a very big trip to Auckland in 2003. I was there for 3 months, and once again I was involved as a medic on the race course. We had two chase boats on the race course in Auckland for the Challenger Series and also for the Cup itself. So very fortunately I was able to join one of those teams, and that came about through associations that I'd made with hosting people from New Zealand here in Perth. When Andy was doing some match racing, and so we'd met some people, and that's how it came about. And that was a terrific event to go to. I also spent quite a bit of time in Valencia in 2007 for the America's Cup up there in Spain. And like Fremantle in Valencia, that place changed dramatically as a result of the America's Cup. The America's Cup goes back in 2024 to Barcelona in Spain. And that will also be a very good event, I expect. But yes, I went to all of those events and had fun at all of them. I then went to the America's Cup in San Francisco in 2013. I mentioned earlier that we had a family member, Andy, sailing in the Artemis team. So it was a good opportunity for a dad to stay with the son, use his beers out of his fridge, leave the lights on, go out and leave the doors unlocked, and you get your own back on the younger generation. So I had a great time in San Francisco. What a great place that is. Loved it.
Took me a while to realise you're referring to the dad and not the son.
Lots of similarities in San Francisco and Fremantle, I reckon.
I think I'd want to be back in Valencia. They do great paella down there on the ocean front, from memory.
Great paella down at the Albufeira there, where they grow all that rice, and so there's a lot of paella there. And yes, we ate a fair bit of paella there. It was good fun there. And working in the media as I was, thanks to a number of people that got me involved in the media, I was able to hang out with a lot of world yachting journalists and a lot of journalists who actually were in yachting as well as other sports who came to the America's Cup. I mean, people like Angus Phillips, who worked for the Washington Post, and other people that came from England and worked for the Guardian, and even our own John Robeson from Fremantle. Many people know Robo, and
yes, they do.
So I spent a fair bit of time with Robo at some of these regattas, and that's been a great joy too.
You'd have to be fit for that. So, talking about the world in a larger setting, we touched on this a little bit with, in a sense, a community sailing club like Fremantle Sailing Club. It's physically integrated. People can join up. Sometimes, like opera and ballet, sailing and sailing clubs can appear to people on the outside to be sort of elitist activities, and you need a lot of money to participate in them. What about the ordinary folk, people who want their kids to be sailors, or their kids want to be sailors? How do they get into it?
There are no barriers to anyone being in a sailing club. You just turn up to the yacht club, walk straight through the gates, and look for the sailing officer there, and say, we'd like to go sailing, and the kids can come down there, and off they go. And even if they don't want to buy a boat, the yacht clubs have boats of their own, and so they can go to the next level on the boats of their own before they've had to pay for all of that expense. Mind you, some of the gear that the kids like to wear is pretty expensive, but they do get in okay. So there's no barriers to sailing, and then they can take their own path after that. But hey, Michael, you mentioned about the ballet and the arts and the people and yacht clubs. There have been events all over the world and events in different places, and even events at the Royal Perth Yacht Club that I can remember, where the arts integrate with those places. So having the ballet in the Quarry Amphitheatre, well, why not at the Fremantle Sailing Club?
Why not indeed?
Why not have that there? Why not have some of the musical events at the Fremantle Sailing Club, or even at Royal Perth Yacht Club Annex? There's a beautiful venue.
Yes.
Lovely indeed. Small venue, yeah. Nice outdoor environment, great for functions. And I'm sure that the integration of that, and we talked a bit about that earlier, is so the yacht clubs are not only welcoming to new sailors of all ages, but I would imagine through my associations welcoming to the wider community at large.
Yeah. It, as we've heard, pretty much since you could go and do it, you've been mixed up in sailing one way or another. You've been sailing, you're in the media. What are a couple of the things that have stood out for you over the years when you look back at your career in sailing? What sort of took your breath away?
My breath was taken away by the America's Cup win in 1987. It's one of the most amazing sporting achievements.
Our win?
No, in 1983 when they won in America in 1983. Yes. Sorry, in 1983 when they won that. That was absolutely spectacular.
And why was that so?
Well, it was held tightly and closeted for all those years. And to break that barrier not only involved the design and the technology from a little small country like Australia, but it involved somebody who actually managed all of that. And Warren Jones, he managed that. He managed the expectation, he managed the boat, he managed the whole of the crew. And to manage that is what took my breath away, because, you know, life's about the people, hey, and the people and how they blend together. That's what's one of the big things that's taken my breath away. I'm also fascinated by the Vendée Globe and the achievement and the athleticism of these people single-handedly on a boat going around the world, 80, 72 days and this sort of thing. It's absolutely amazing achievement, and they're bumping all the way. It's like an aerobic exercise they're doing the whole way around the world. They've got to plan the food, they've got to plan the water, they've got to make sure the equipment works. It's a massive achievement. I'm blown away by that, but I'm blown away mostly, I guess, by the fun of sailing, the fun that people have with sailing. You see a child in an Optimist heading out there in 25 knots out of the Fremantle Sailing Club, and they hit the big time on their thing, and the smile off their faces, you cannot wipe the smile off their face. And you get a sailor that wins a race, like when you go to the Flying 15 results, when they come out on Saturday, the winners will be grinning, but not only will the winners be grinning at the beginning, after a short time, they'll all be grinning and laughing because the people are happy. It makes people happy, the sport of sailing. That's what blows me away, I think. It's the fun that we have.
Yeah, it's been absolutely delightful talking to you here in Fremantle. I mean, what is it about Fremantle that has us older codgers tinkering around the place, do you think?
It's the beautiful buildings, it's the hidden areas, it's the people, the eclectic people that live and work in here, some of whom you never find out. I've been around this area pretty much all my life, as we've been talking about today, but tomorrow you'll run into somebody that's been around this place for a long time doing amazing things. And all of a sudden it's discovered, and it's that discovery that sort of you want to get up the next morning and find them. And very fortunately in my job, I've met a lot of these people, a lot of the good guys, a lot of the shady guys, a lot of the arts guys, a lot of people that are the eclectic characters of Fremantle. Very fortunately in my work, I've come across a lot of these people, so that's pretty cool. I really like it.
Ed, thanks for talking to the Shipping News.
It's been a pleasure, Michael.